My name is Ben Burrell, and this is Bob Dylan Album by Album, a podcast that brings you an in-depth look at each Bob Dylan studio recording, record by record. Welcome to season 7. I can't believe it. 7 seasons of this. I don't want to start the whole season with an apology, but here we are. Do you know what? This has a little prelude to it, because the other day I was giving a little talk, a little kind of seminar, if you will, about podcasting and radio. I work in radio, and one of my first things was to say, if you're going to be a podcaster, if you're going to work in radio, if you're going to put out audio content of any kind, you need to do it regularly and you need to do it consistently. And I thought in the back of my mind, that podcast I do that I love has not gone out for almost a year now. But you know, this is a slightly different podcast, your run-of-the-mill podcast. It's not just two people chatting. There's other stuff involved in it. So I can only apologise about the wait between seasons. That is my fault. I've had a couple of big projects, including actually a Dylan project that I'll be talking more and more about over the next couple of weeks. That's taken up my time, but we are back now for season 7. Got some great albums to look at. Got some not so good albums to look at. Today's is definitely a great album. We'll start with New Morning in just a second. First though, let's mention some Patreon subscribers. So even when the podcast isn't running, I do an extra show on Patreon, which is a subscription service. It's £5 a month. You get some episodes that are similar to this and some interviews as well. Quite a bit on there now, actually. Some episodes have gone out recently that I'm really proud of too, including an interview with Kevin Odegaard, who played on the Blood on the Tracks album. He gave us a real fascinating insight to those second round of sessions on the Blood on the Tracks album. He was a really good storyteller, actually, and just had so much to say, and was a really good insight and fascinating to hear from someone that was at the birth of such an important album. He was great. I did an episode looking at the song Joker Man line by line and what that means and what that song was all about. I also have a little mini series going about Dylan's influences. The latest episode of that was on Woody Guthrie, and I spoke to Jeff Slate recently too, who has written the liner notes for More Blood, More Tracks, and spoke to us about the kind of dealings with Dylan's office, which was actually an interesting insight to the kind of business side of Dylan's operation, actually. They are all available on the Patreon right now. There's a link to that in this episode's description if you fancy it. As I say, it's £5 a month. Loads of new subscribers, actually, so let's say hello to some, shall we? Hi to John Litcher. Hi to Joachim. Hi to Emily Naftalian. I think I'm saying that right. Hi to Wim as well. Thank you for your subscription. Hello to Chris Baker. Hi to Eileen King. Hi to Just Simon. One name there, like Prince. Hi to Nathaniel Pranger. Hi to John Sanna. Hi to Anya. Hi to Kevin Lopatan. Hi to Mike Keller. Hi to Thor. Hi to Francesca. Hi to Mark Smith. And hello to Timothy Dodge as well. More shout-outs next week. As I say, you can subscribe to the extra show. Have a little look. The link is in this episode's description. Let's get to the first episode of Season 7, shall we? This is such a fun album, which is unusual when it comes to Dylan's back catalogue. I love this record. I think it's just a really easy listen in the best possible way. Let's have a look at 1970s New Morning. New Morning is a record of change. Its appropriate name repeats its themes of rebirth and a new life, which is all over the album. It's a record that reflects its author's newfound existence. It sees Dylan return to a New York recording studio after a dalliance with the country styles of Nashville. It also sees him release a proper record rather than the official bootleg idea of the preceding LP, Self-Portrait. It also is released at the start of a brand new decade. The 60s belonged to Dylan, but the 70s, they were a new morning. Coming only 4 months after the explosion, or some would say implosion, of Self-Portrait, New Morning would be seen as a return to form for Dylan. For me, it's a record that announces a new era. While Nashville Skyline and John Wesley Harding were still released in the 60s, they kind of existed in their own Dylan era. They are albums that were released in the wake of Dylan's 66 motorcycle crash. In fact, those records feel like he is still digesting the previous era, like those two albums were him shaking off the intensity of Blonde on Blonde or Highway 61, whereas this album feels like it's set on a different path. New Morning shares the hint of domesticity found on other records after Dylan's crash, but here the whole thing is emboldened. It feels like Dylan is basking in this newfound life. He's living in the country. He's a father. He's a husband. He likes to have people over. He likes to hang out with the band and make music and get away from the madness that seemed to follow him around previously. I guess here he's more white picket fence than white line. He's no longer that amphetamine rock star. He's a different man. Even the cover of the album suggests this. Dylan looks unassuming, shy even. The picture is framed by that slightly yellowed border, and it's of a man with a spindly beard. He's dressed in a suit. He's looking learned, wise. He's looking content. A far cry from the blurry urban shot of Blonde on Blonde, or even the fairly similar composition yet very different inference image of the clean-cut Nashville skyline cover. That man we see on that cover may be the true representation of the Bob Dylan that was existing at that time. In the years after the motorcycle crash of 66, Bob had been hanging around in Woodstock. Time had passed, albeit slowly, and he'd become a wiser figure, perhaps. His days would be spent dropping the kids off at school and painting with his neighbour, an artist called Bruce Dorfman. This all came from Sarah, Dylan's wife at the time. She bought him some oil paintings for his 27th birthday. He was now years into this Woodstock existence, and clearly it was working for him. Professionally, it hadn't quite been as good a time. After the 60s, there was not a lot of places for Dylan to go, really. He'd almost done it all in that decade, which is why Self-Portrait has always had the air of self-destruction about it. Obviously, he wasn't going to be as successful in the 70s as he had been in the 60s. That was almost impossible. Probably not commercially, but almost definitely critically. Even though in hindsight, he does get pretty close in places in the 70s. When comparing that to his 60s output. And while John Wesley Harding and Nashville Skyline are good records, great even, they're not Blonde on Blonde standard. So while Self-Portrait is still reverberating around as Dylan's lowest creative point, at that moment anyway, he did the best possible thing. He came back with an accessible album, an album that is actually full of potential hits. But not in a desperate attempt to regain some lost commercial ground. They're actually a byproduct of a lack of pressure. It's a free and easy record, an album that sounds like it was an artist doing what they wanted to do, and that was to have fun, to bask in the glory of their newfound life, to escape everything they had been before. While John Wesley Harding had had a more intense biblical tone and Nashville Skyline had felt like a little country music holiday, New Morning was Dylan moving on, even if it wasn't a conscious decision. Because here, he's pretty happy. The whole thing starts with a love song. But of course, this is New Morning. It's not a love song featuring heartbreak. This is a love song in capital letters.
If not for you, babe, I couldn't find the door, couldn't even see the floor. I'd be sad and blue if not for you.
This song is very special for me personally. It was the first dance of my wedding. And it's a very special song for New Morning too. Dylan starts the album with, well, just a really good track. It's just a simple song. It's kind of the opposite of Sad Eyed Lady of the Lowlands, despite these songs being potentially about the same person. It loses that weighty importance and replaces it with just joy and love. It's a sort of song that felt a mile off on any number of albums from Dylan up to this point. It's contented. Its simple rhyme structure and lyrics mean that it's not only a good song, but an accessible one too. Hell, as I say, the whole album is accessible. Another important step at this point for Dylan's career. And while I'm sure he didn't sit down and plan a commercial-sounding record, he has one here, and that would only benefit his career in the long run. Of course, Dylan has never sounded unaccessible, even if he tried to engage that at times. But my point is, you can hear a song like If Not For You on any number of radio playlists or wedding ceremonies or anywhere still to this day. So much so, the song, continuing a long Dylan tradition, has been covered many times, most notably and famously by George Harrison. It's also been made into a kids' reading book, which I can fully recommend via my three-year-old. And in fact, his lyrics are almost nursery rhyme-like. It's a cutesy love song that never grates too much and never gets overly cheesy. Dylan sings stuff like, "If not for you, babe, I couldn't even find the door. I couldn't even see the floor. I'd be sad and blue if not for you." This is sung over that skitty, relaxed soundtrack, which sounds like it comes from the country without belonging to the country genre. Again, it's the perfect way to start the album. It really does indicate what's in store for us over the next 30-odd minutes. It's relaxed and sober, kind of playful, but ultimately content. That's pretty much where we find ourselves on track three, Time Passes Slowly. This song is apparently one of the few songs that Dylan had composed for a play. It was a piece by Archibald MacLeish, who was a decorated writer. In his memoir, Dylan called MacLeish one of the poet laureates of America. The new play he'd written, which was to contain Dylan's music, was called Scratch. After working on some songs for him, Dylan apparently found the play a little too dark, heavy even, and MacLeish found Dylan's trial songs too light. After a meeting at his home, they went their separate ways. Dylan, though, would use some of his Scratch efforts on New Morning, including the aforementioned Time Passes Slowly and the album's title track. This lack of collaboration with MacLeish appears to be the genesis for the album, although the process was given a shot in the arm by Bob Johnston, the producer who had become a regular Dylan collaborator, and you get the impression that Johnston particularly wanted to continue that. He apparently phoned Bob and asked him if he had any songs. Dylan, seemingly interested, agreed to record some of the leftover Scratch songs and, quote, make up more in the studio. But he didn't seem to be overly set on making an album in bold type. Dylan is quoted in Chronicles as saying, "If my records were still selling, then why wouldn't I be thinking about recording?" Which is probably why New Morning sounds the way it does. Sure, he wants to record a new record, but it's not his only focus in the entire universe. Dylan describes Johnston as a man with momentum. He seems to be the driving force here too. Bob mentions his producing style was to oil up the machines and let them rip, which again is probably the reason why New Morning sounds as it does. But it was also great for Dylan. This sense of anything could happen in the studio is what appears to make for a good creative home for Bob Dylan's song ideas. This would change as his career moves on, but for now, perhaps with a slightly less motivated Dylan and some less concrete ideas, it would probably be the best approach for this record. The two Bobs went to New York rather than Johnston's first love of Nashville, where they had been operating for a while. The only requirement Dylan gave his producer was to bring in his longtime keys player Al Cooper into the sessions. Johnston would do the rest. Dylan's return to New York wasn't quite the complete homecoming, though. He didn't go back to Columbia's Studio A, where he'd cut albums like Highway 61. He was, in fact, going to Studio B. A had been situated on 7th Avenue, which had four studios, an editing and mastering facility, and other rooms. But later they moved to 49 East and 52nd Street to Studio B after a corporate sale. Bob and the band started recording there on the 1st of May 1970, and they were joined by a former Beatle. George Harrison was a relatively new friend of Dylan's at this point, but they had definitely crossed the line of pop star acquaintance to firm pals. Harrison himself was starting to record what would become the classic All Things Must Pass album. Here he'd play on a number of songs that would make up New Morning. Sadly, none of the cuts would end up actually on the track listing, but they would be released in the 1970 bootleg coming over 50 years later in 2021. In fact, none of the songs recorded that day would make it onto the final album at all, and the record's next session on the 1st of June would result in a similar fate. In that session, they'd record some traditional songs and some other covers. The next session on the 2nd of June is, again, not too fruitful. The classic song Spanish Is the Loving Tongue is recorded, which Dylan has played with a couple of times in the studio down the years. If Not For You also gets a couple of outings, as does some material that would end up on the bodged Columbia album Dylan, released in 1973. Songs like Mary Ann, which didn't really hit the sweet spot. It wasn't until the end of the next session on the 3rd that they would finally find a New Morning cut. That song was One More Weekend.
Slipping and sliding like a weasel on the run. I'm looking good to see you, yeah, and we
can have some fun. One more weekend, one more weekend with you.
Despite being one of the first songs recorded for the LP, it was not an indication of the record's sound. It's a straightforward bluesy number with a great vocal from Dylan. Like elsewhere on the LP, he seems to have a slight cold, which weirdly becomes a trademark of this album. The song, however, does act as a good indication of where Dylan was going themically on the LP. Like we've heard, after his escape act perpetuated by the motorcycle crash of 66, Dylan was a renewed figure. He'd successfully run away from his former existence, diving headfirst into love and family. We hear of something similar on this track. He sings, "Slipping and sliding like a weasel on the run. I'm looking good to see you, yeah, and we can have some fun. One more weekend with you." Here, our narrator is revelling in his spare time, his lover and their free existence. He's living a constant weekend. On the next session, they managed to get even more cuts onto tape, one being the title track.
So happy just to see you smile underneath the sky blue on this new morning.
New Morning is a straightforward tune in many respects. It also has a killer chorus, one of my favourites from Dylan ever, in fact. And this album doesn't shy away from those. They Are the Locusts, The Man in Me, and this song are all melodic high points that perhaps, given a little more studio regulation, would have become radio smashes in time. We're brought to that big chorus with a couple of minor chords, B minor and C minor, as Dylan sings lines like "So happy just to see you smile," before we explode with major chords of D and A. This is all presented to us with Al Cooper's dynamic organ and Russ Kunkel's raucous drums.
Underneath the sky blue, all this new.
This is unlike a lot of Dylan's songs from the quite intense era before. While at times those songs might have felt like he had the weight of the world on his shoulders, here he's basking in the glory of life and everything it has to offer. There's not a more perfect phrase for it than "New Morning." Have we ever heard Dylan as happy as this, as he sings lines like "Can you feel that sun a-shining, groundhog running by the country stream? This must be the day that all of my dreams come true. So happy just to be alive underneath the sky of blue on this new morning with you." And while I'm the first to throw on a sad song, in fact the saddest song possible, and strangely find some sort of joy in that, this is proof that Dylan can really do it all. The other song they recorded on the same day as this is the track "Three Angels." This song does two things for me. It highlights New Morning's strangeness, in that it does things you're not really expecting. See track 6, "If Dogs Run Free." But it also gives us the smallest of peeks into what is to come. Just like we saw with John Wesley Harding, Dylan is mentioning God and the Bible here. Nothing new there, but it is overt. And that's something we'd see more and more as we head through this decade and through this album too.
Three angels up above the street, each one playing a horn, dressed in green robes with wings that stick out.
Now, usually I'm not particularly a fan of spoken word songs, and at times I can take or leave this track. But what it does do, like a lot of this album, is add to Dylan's catalogue. None of his other albums sound really like this one. Sure, Nashville Skyline, Self Portrait, and at points John Wesley Harding all share DNA with moments that happen here, but New Morning is a bit of a different gear for Dylan. Which is why, for me, it's a pretty enduring record, one that I return to again and again, because it is a real point of difference in his back catalogue. Sure, this song isn't Last Thoughts on Woody Guthrie, but Three Angels does offer a pretty nice detour on this album. As for who the three angels are that are watching over our world, well, they could be an omen. The Three Angels' Messages is an interpretation of the messages given by three angels in Revelation 14:6 to 14:12. Some teachings believe that these messages are given to prepare the world for the second coming of Jesus. In the song, Bob sings, three fellas crawling on their way back to work. Nobody stops to ask why. The bakery truck stops outside of that fence where the angels stand high on their poles. The driver peeks out, trying to find one face in this concrete world full of souls. The angels play on their horns all day. The whole earth in progression seems to pass by. But does anyone hear the music they play? Does anyone even try? Which could be a little shrug at the world's supposed lack of faith, a lack of interest in anything other than the day-to-day and the mundanity of that scene that the song is set in. Either that or Dylan just didn't have much material in the studio and rattled off a few poetic lines over some music. Either way, it's an album-enhancing track, if unspectacular. In the same session as this song, they also tackle Tomorrow Is a Long Time, a song that would end up on Dylan's greatest hits. They also record a cover of Big Yellow Taxi by Joni Mitchell, which would end up on the aforementioned Dylan album. It's the next session where things would really take off. On the 5th of June, they managed to get six songs finished and recorded. The first of the day is possibly my least favourite song on the record. It's a song that came out of nowhere. In Chronicles, Dylan said that Al Cooper was messing around on the piano playing some Teddy Wilson riffs with an unnamed backing singer doing some improv scat singing. It ended in the track, If Dogs Run Free.
If dogs run free, then what must be, must be, and that is all. True love can make a blade of grass stand up straight and tall.
Dylan says this song was done in just one take. The studio log says it was three, so perhaps there were two run-throughs and the finished song was captured in its entirety in one go. The finished song certainly does sound like a one-hit wonder, if you like. The quality of the recording is actually pretty good, if so, but I have a hard time getting too excited about its content. Impressive, though, that it was all done on the fly. It is a very New Morning song, though, with all things considered. Like we've seen, it's something a little different, and it has a sense of freedom about it, least of all from the title. After that, there's four attempts at the song Went to See the Gypsy. They get it on the fourth try. It had been attempted during the self-portrait sessions, along with Time Passes Slowly and If Not For You, but finally Dylan gets it here for this album, as he does with the other two, and this is a great cut.
Went to see the gypsy, staying in a big hotel. He smiled when he saw me coming, and he said, well, well, well. His room was dark and crowded. Lights were low and dim. How are you? He said to me. I said it back to him.
The story behind the song is apparently to do with a fictional meeting between Bob and Elvis. Dylan had confirmed the pair have never actually met. He mentioned to Rolling Stone, saying, I never met Elvis because I didn't want to meet Elvis. Elvis was in his 60s movie period and he was just cracking them out and knocking them off, one after another. And Elvis had kind of fallen out of favour in the 60s. He didn't really come back until whenever it was, 68? Although Dylan writer Clinton Halen says the two did meet. However, the only source he cites is an interview with New Morning session guitarist Ron Cornelius, who says that he asked Dylan about the song Went to See the Gypsy, and he told him it was about meeting Elvis in Las Vegas. Which doesn't really mean the two did meet. It can still be about that without the event actually taking place. The lyrics in the song do hint at the King. There's the Vegas mention in the line, he did it in Vegas and he can do it here. And another that concentrates on the first moments of the meeting between the narrator and the gypsy, which contains the phrase, well, well, well. Which apparently, according to quite a few people, hints that Elvis is at the root of this song, because he used the phrase quite a lot. Now, before you start sniggering, there is a compelling YouTube playlist that does back up this claim to a degree. For me, though, it does feel a little weak. What we do know is that Dylan loved Elvis. He was crushed when the King died, so much so, apparently, that he didn't speak for a week afterwards. Regardless, the song, although perhaps inspired by the non-meeting with Elvis, is perhaps more about missed opportunities. After an initial meeting with the gypsy, who is an Elvis-like figure, our narrator returns to find they are gone. Dylan sings, "I went back to see the gypsy. It was nearly early dawn. The gypsy's door was open wide, but the gypsy was gone. And that pretty dancing girl, she could not be found. So I watched the sun come rising from that little Minnesota town." The final line is a nice finale, and Dylan knows it. Bob was born and grew up in Minnesota, born in Duluth and raised in Hibbing. So he mentions his home in the final line, which for me might lead us to think this song has a personal side for him. While he might have brushed against this exciting, rich character who has a big hotel room and has been successful in Vegas, he's not fully taken everything he wanted from the exchange, as the gypsy is now gone and our narrator is left looking for him. So he's left at the end alone, perhaps feeling like a little kid, like the one he used to be when he was growing up in that little Minnesota town. Perhaps the power and excitement of the gypsy has reminded him of that. Perhaps this character has humbled our narrator, made him realise he is still a servant to people like him. He's not at the top of the mountain like our gypsy character. Which kind of fits with Dylan's newfound life in Woodstock. The fame from before has definitely lost its intensity somewhat. Now, the gypsy could easily be Elvis, or fame, or Dylan's career up to this point. The post-crash Dylan would certainly have felt feelings like the one he's describing at the end there. Al Cooper remembers cutting this song, but it's far from a happy memory, by all accounts. He says, "When I finished that album, I never wanted to speak to Dylan again. I was cheesed off at how difficult the whole thing was. He just changed his mind every 3 seconds, so I ended up doing the work of 3 albums. We got a side order, and then we'd go in and master it, and he'd say, 'No, no, I want to do this.' And then he'd say, 'No, no, no, let's do this, let's cut this.' There was another version of Went to See the Gypsy that was really good. It was the first time we did it, and I went in, and we had the arrangement for it, an idea that I had, and I said, 'Let's go in and cut this track, and then you can sing over it.' So I cut the track, and it was really good, and he came in and pretended like he didn't understand where to sing on it." Which to me sounds like classic Bob behaviour. You love to see it. This piano-led song shares its sonics and recording day with another, Sign on the Window. In fact, that Al Cooper quote kind of resonates with me a little bit, but for different reasons. I do see New Morning as 3 albums in one, if you like. You have these more piano-sounding songs, like the 2 I've mentioned, and The Man in Me and Time Passes Slowly. Then you have the bigger carefree numbers, like Day of the Locusts and New Morning and If Not For You. And then you have the outliers, like 3 Angels, If Dogs Run Free and Winterludes. But Sign on the Window and The Man in Me are definite real moments of quality. They do bring a little bit of quality to this album. It's not an LP that lacks that per se, but its carefree composition and carefree themes means that it will never match the high-functioning albums in Bob's catalogue like Blood on the Tracks or Time Out of Mind. But New Morning still shows its chops on these cuts.
Build me a cabin in Utah. Marry me a wife, catch rainbow trout. Have a bunch of kids who call me Pa. That must be what it's all.
Sign on the Window is possibly the most beautiful moment on the whole LP. Dylan's Nashville croon briefly returns as he treats us to a proper ballad. His cold is also more than present on a few lines here, particularly the line about Brighton girls are like the moon. The domestic bliss we've heard creeping into Dylan's work in this era is front and centre here, especially on the final verse as he sings, "Build me a cabin in Utah. Marry me a wife, catch rainbow trout. Have a bunch of kids who call me Pa. That must be what it's all about." In fact, this is one of the starkest representations of the album's underlying meaning. The song, which had been attempted a few times before this session, also carries over to an overdub session. Not usually what Dylan likes to do, but they added a string section to it and some Al Kooper overdubs too, both coming on the 13th of July. The song The Man in Me continues along the feeling found in the final lines of Sign on the Window. In fact, once again, Dylan has never sounded so joyous as he does here. Listen to his ragtag intro. Oh, and at this point, we must give a shout out to all the Big Lebowski fans listening. La, la, la. Here we have a narrator once again basking in the glory of his lover. She has seen a part of him that not many do. It is, in its very essence, like If Not For You, love in its purest form.
Man in me will do nearly any task. And ask for compensation, there's a little he would ask.
Dylan sings lines like, storm clouds are raging all around my door. I think to myself I might not be able to take any more. Take a woman like your kind to find the man in me. And later, accompanied with a wonderful vocal from Bob, he sings a bridge-like chorus of, but oh, what a wonderful feeling, just to know that you are near. It sets my heart a-reeling from my toes up to my ears. The first line there, I've always felt, was a reference to the classic song On the Streets Where You Live, and the line from that song's chorus, which reads, for oh, the towering feeling, just to know somehow you are near, that overpowering feeling that any second you may suddenly appear. Dylan, of course, mentions that song on 2020's Murder Most Foul with the line, we're right down the street from the street where you live. The Man in Me is one of my favourites on the whole New Morning album, and for different reasons I also like Day of the Locusts. Its chorus is one of the album highlights I mentioned.
Oh, the benches were stained with tears and perspiration. The birdies were flying from tree to tree. There was little to say, there was no conversation. As I stepped to the stage pick up my degree, and the locust sang off in the distance. Yeah, the locust sang.
Interestingly, the song itself is non-fiction. It has something to do with a group of cicadas known as Brood X. No, really. Brood X hits every 17 years. That means they lie underground for that time, emerging in late spring and early summer to wreak havoc on the east coast of America. Now, those cicadas hit Princeton University on the day that Bob Dylan was visiting. Bob was at the university to pick up an honorary degree. Unsurprisingly, given all we know about Bob, he wasn't too excited about that. In fact, he had to be talked into it, even if later he would confess that he did enjoy receiving it. Sarah, his wife at the time, did most of the coercing, but also David Crosby played his part too. Yes, that David Crosby from Crosby, Stills and Nash. Crosby is a friend of Dylan's. There's a quote in his autobiography that I love. It is as follows. I get along with Dylan pretty well. I get along with pretty well now because I've managed to keep him from knowing that I'm impressed, at least until he reads this. The minute you let him know that you're completely impressed with him, he starts to mess with you. He'll stir your brain like he has a spoon. Of the event at Princeton University, Crosby says, Sarah was trying to get Bob to go to the university, where he was being presented with some honorary doctorate. Bob did not want to go. I said, come on, Bob, it's an honor. So Sarah and I both worked on him for a long time, and finally, he agreed. This lack of desire to go sets the tone for the song's lyrics, as we open with, oh, the benches were stained with tears and perspiration. The birdies were flying from tree to tree. There was little to say, there was no conversation as I stepped to the stage to pick up my degree. While those opening lines aren't particularly raging, there is bitterness lurking around them. In the next section, we have the locust introduced. He sings, and the locust sang off in the distance. Yeah, the locust sang such a sweet melody.
And the locust sang off in the distance, yeah. Locusts sang, off in the distance, down the locusts sang, and they were
Dylan doesn't seem to be in a good way, by all accounts. In fact, in a report from Rolling Stone, they mention his behaviour. They're quoted as saying, he came romping in his shades, and he was very nervous. He was extremely uncommunicative, talking only in a mumble and speaking through either Crosby or Ben Saltzman, his aide. In his 2004 memoir, Chronicles, Bob says he was introduced at the event as the authentic expression of the disturbed and concerned conscience of young America. This did not sit well with him. I couldn't believe it, he says. Tricked once more, the sunlight was blocking my vision, but I could see the faces gawking at me with such strange expressions. I was so mad, I wanted to bite myself. So this song is Dylan pushing back once again against his reputation that has been forced upon him. Sadly, he seems to have spent most of his career trying to shift that with varying success. The album's closing track is also his shortest on any studio record. But that doesn't mean it's not important.
Father of night, father of day, father who taketh the darkness away, father who teacheth the bird to fly, builder of rainbows up in the sky, father of loneliness and pain, father of love and father of rain.
Father of Night gives us a peek into Dylan's shifting attention. Like we heard on Three Angels, we're once again thinking of God.
Father of day, father of night, father of black, father of white.
Dylan has always used the Bible and been interested in its stories. However, it had been shaping his songs overtly more and more in this era, particularly on the John Wesley Harding LP and in songs like Wicked Messenger. In fact, Dylan's growing interest in it was heightened by his mother, Beatty. She's quoted as saying, in his house in Woodstock today, there's a huge Bible open on a stand in the middle of his study. Of all the books that crowd his house and overflow from his house, the Bible gets the most attention. He's continuously getting up and going over to it to refer to something. The song is Dylan's interpretation of the Jewish prayer, Amidah. Along with the Shema, the Amidah is one of two main prayers that people of the Jewish faith are likely to use. It's the central prayer used in worship services. It's often referred to as the standing prayer and is always recited while standing and facing Jerusalem. The prayer consists of 19 blessings, which can be split into three sections: the praising of God, the asking for help, and thanksgiving. And in the Dylan song, we have three sections too. Well, three verses, at least. It doesn't really go anywhere apart from to praise God. But as a song, I like it, even if it is somewhat of a muted conclusion to the album. But as we've seen before, mainly with Restless Farewell, and to a lesser extent, It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, and I'll Be Your Baby Tonight, the song acts as a precursor to what would come next for Bob. Restless Farewell was a goodbye to the folk scene, as was It's All Over Now, Baby Blue, in a way. I'll Be Your Baby Tonight showed a country croon that would be continued onto the next album, Nashville Skyline, and here on this song we see themes and lyrics that would occupy Dylan's mind later in the decade. By the time the song finishes, New Morning emerges as an LP that was good enough to be called a comeback. Of course, Dylan would have bigger and better comeback albums. But after the division of Self-Portrait, Bob needed to make an album like this. Songs like If Dogs Run Free and Winterlude mean that this album will never be a top-tier Dylan record. But alternatively, tracks like The Man in Me and Sign on the Window and If Not For You means that it's full of substance. Also, that different quality that I've mentioned gives the album an outlier feel that means it's an interesting record to revisit. It's got some nice ideas, and its ramshackle recording and delivery means it never seems to play the same way twice. Also, like we've come to see with many a Dylan album, it has its role to play when it comes to his back catalogue as a whole. Without New Morning, we'd have a tough period for Bob. It gives us a little bit of life between albums like the aforementioned Self-Portrait and the disastrous Dylan in 1973. Without New Morning's depth, we'd also be relying solely on the Pat Garrett soundtrack to give us some substance in this era. And Knocking on Heaven's Door aside, that is asking a lot, despite the fact it being a more than competent record. So this LP is a good bridging album, if that is to be its job. Taken on its own, though, it's an album that gave us a Dylan we rarely get to see. He was content and relaxed and trying some ideas out. While it might not be the most dynamic record of all time, it, like Dylan always does, gives us something we weren't quite expecting.
Time passes slowly here in the mountains. We sit beside bridges and walk beside fountains. Catch the wild fishes that float through the stream. Time passes slowly when you're lost in a dream.
That's it for today's episode. As always, share your thoughts on New Morning, please. You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Bob Dylan Podcast. Also, can you leave me a review, please, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts? We had quite a few recently. They've slowed up a little bit, though, in the last week or so. So if you're a big fan of the show, if you listen to the podcast regularly and you haven't left a review yet, then it would be great for you to do that. That'd be much appreciated. And like I always say, if you can slip in a little Dylan reference, a niche Dylan reference, then that is more than appreciated. Do that, please, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts. And I think you can also rate some shows on Spotify now. That's a new feature brought in some areas on Spotify. So if you can do that, that's, again, more than appreciated. Also, don't forget the Patreon link is in this episode's description. Actually, we did an episode looking at the song Day of the Locust, which is on the Patreon feed right now, having a proper deep dive into what exactly happened that day. I know I mentioned it in this episode, but we go into it in much more detail on the Patreon feed. So if you fancy that, as I say, the link is in the episode's description. Back next week with another album, and well, it's not so good next week. We're having a look at the album Down in the Groove, which, you know, is definitely not one of Dylan's best albums, more likely one of his worst albums. But we'll look at the positives of that record and the many, many negatives too. So join me next time for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and I'll see you down the road.